ridge overlooking the camp sat four leader houses built in Heimatschutzstil, homeland preserving style, with natural stone columns and half-timbered balconies. A mix of Nordic and German styles, pleasing to the eye. This was a place of superior value. High class, one might even call it.
Up on the ridge, the one overlooking the camp, is the commandant's house, Fritz said.
If not for the glimpse of high stone walls topped with barbed wire behind the administration building, one might have mistaken the camp for a convalescent home, not a re-education camp for prisoners. I was determined to like Commandant Kugel. Those of superior rank can always tell if a subordinate does not like them, and this can be fatal to a career. Just inside the camp gates, a caged aviary which held monkeys and parrots and other exotic birds stood off to the side of the road, the only incongruous element. Animals reduce stress, certainly, but what was the purpose of such a collection?
You waiting for the butler, Hertha? Fritz called to me from the doorway.
A secretary ushered me across parquet floors, upstairs and into the commandant's office, where Kugel sat at his desk under a rectangular mirror, which reflected the man-sized potted plant in the corner. It was hard not to be intimidated by the grandeur of his office. The wall-to-wall carpeting, the expensive-looking draperies, and the chandelier. He even had his own porcelain sink. All at once, I wished I'd shined my shoes.
Kugel stood, and we exchanged the German salute. "You're late, Dr. Oberhäuser," he said.
The Black Forest clock on his wall chimed the half-hour. Dirndled and Lederhosen dancers twirled out of their arched doorways to Der fröhliche Wanderer, celebrating my tardiness.
"Dr. Fischer," I began, "do you always blame others for your mistakes?"
"I'm sorry to be late, Herr Kommandant." He folded his arms across his chest.
"How was your trip?"
He was a fleshy sort, something I ordinarily dislike in a person, but I forced a smile. Kugel's second-floor view offered a wide expanse of the camp and overlooked a vast yard where women prisoners stood at attention, five abreast. A road bisected the camp, covered with black slag, which glittered in the sun. Neat rows of barracks stood perpendicular to this road and extended into the distance. How nice to see immature linden trees, the hallowed Tree of Lovers in German folklore, planted at regular intervals along the road. "It was a comfortable trip, Commandant," I said, doing my best to lose my Rhineland accent. "Thank you for the first-class ticket."
"Comfort is important to you?" Kugel asked.
The Commandant was a stern man with stumpy legs and a sour disposition. Perhaps his unpleasant demeanor was due in part to his regulation brown shirt collar and tie, so tight they squeezed the adipose tissue up around his neck, making it look like a lardy muffler. The friction had produced a bumper crop of skin tags, which hung flaccid along the edges of his collar. He wore a cluster of medals at his chest. At least he was a patriot.
"Not really, Commandant. I'm afraid there has been a mix-up," he said with a wave of his hand. "We cannot accommodate you here."
"But I received a letter from Berlin."
"You will be the only woman doctor here. That presents problems."
"I didn't think..."
"This is a work camp, doctor. No fancy beauty salons, no coffee clutches. How will men feel about you eating in the officer's canteen? One woman among so many men spells trouble."
I felt the salary floating away as he spoke. Would Fritz take me to the next train back to Berlin? Mutti would have to work full-time again. "I'm used to living simply, Herr Kommandant." I released my clenched fists and saw I dug my fingernails into my palms. They left a row of little red smiles, mocking me. I deserved this. When would I learn not to be overconfident? I assure you, I will be fine in any living situation. The Führer himself says simple living is best.
Kugel took in my short haircut. Was he weakening? They sent me a dermatologist. That is no use to us here.
And infectious diseases, Commandant.
He mulled that over, one hand on his belly. I see, he said. He turned to the window and surveyed the camp. Well, we do sensitive work here, Doctor.
As he spoke, the sound of a whip drew my attention to the square below. A female guard lashed one of several prisoners gathered there with a horsewhip.
We require complete confidentiality here, Doctor. Are you willing to sign a statement? You can confide in no one, not even your mother or girlfriends.
Nothing to worry about there. I had no girlfriends.
Any breach of security, and you'll face your family's imprisonment and a possible death penalty for you.
I keep to myself, Herr Commandant.
This work is, well, not for the squeamish. Our medical setup is adequate at best, in a terrible state.
Kugel ignored the spectacle below his window. As the prisoner fell to the ground, her hands folded across the top of her head, the guard intensified the punishment. A second guard held back a leashed Alsatian as it sprang forward, teeth bared.
Well, it would make Berlin happy, Kugel said.
What will my role in re-education be, Herr Commandant? The guard in the courtyard kicked the woman in the midsection with her boot. The woman's screams hard to ignore. This was a violent form of re-education.
You are joining an elite group. You'll work with some of the best doctors in Germany to accommodate the medical needs of the camp staff and their families, and of the women who have been resettled here to do the Führer's work. Dr. Gebhardt has several projects as well.
In the courtyard, the guard rewound her whip, and two prisoners dragged their bloodied companion off as the rest stood at attention.
After your 3 months training period, a resignation will not be accepted under any circumstances.
I understand, Commandant.
Kugel walked back to his desk. You will share a house with Dorothea Binz, our head of female security personnel. Our hair salon is not fancy, but quite good. Right downstairs. The Bible girls operate it. Jehovah's Witnesses. They've dedicated themselves to making my life a living hell, but you can trust them with scissors.
I will keep it in mind, Herr Kommandant, I said, and excused myself with a German salute. I left Kugel's office happy he'd relented, but unsure I wanted to stay at Ravensbrück. A vague, unsettled feeling came over me. What if I just got back on the train for home? I could work 3 jobs if I had to. I was astounded to see my room in the newly built high-ranking wardress's cottage just steps from the entry gate. It was bigger than our whole apartment at home, outfitted with a shared bath complete with shower and tub, a comfortable bed with white eiderdown, and a vanity table. I wore no makeup, per regulations, but the table would make a nice desk. Best of all, the cottage was centrally heated. Such clean, elegant quarters with my own balcony. Mutti would just shake her head in wonder to see me in such a place. I walked into the main camp for lunch, through the personnel entrance, and found the officers' dining hall. The noise level was high, for the small building was packed with SS doctors and guards, including many of the 50 SS doctors assigned to Ravensbrück, all male and all enjoying a lunch of pork roast, buttered potatoes, and various cuts of beef. I hoped to become acquainted with the top-flight doctors Kugel had promised. Though I was in no hurry, the male-female physician ratio was a promising 49-1. As I stepped closer to the table where Fritz held court, groups of men stopped their conversations and stared as I passed. I was used to being among men from medical school, but one woman colleague would have been nice. I found Fritz and his three companions sitting, bellies extended, sharing what seemed like post-coital cigarettes.
"Ah, Hertha," Fritz said. "Careful lunch?"
He motioned to a plate piled with fatty pork chops, and I stemmed a wave of nausea. "I am vegetarian," I said. The man next to him stifled a laugh. Fritz stood.
"Where are my manners? Let me introduce you. At the end of the table there we have Dr. Martin Hellinger, toast of the SS dental world."
Dr. Hellinger was a beetle-browed fellow with wire-rimmed glasses and an endomorphic body type whose blood sugar had apparently dipped so low he could barely acknowledge me. He penciled in answers to a crossword puzzle from a newspaper.
"Next, Dr. Adolf Winckelmann, visiting from Auschwitz."
Winckelmann sat in his chair as if poured there. He was rotund, with skin like wormhole wood.
"And this is the famous Rolf Rosenthal," Fritz said, indicating the weaselly, dark-haired fellow sprawled out in the chair at his left. "Former Navy surgeon and our gynecological wunderkind."
Rosenthal leaned forward into his cigarette and looked at me as a cow merchant considers a purchase. The slam of a screen door caused the doctors to turn, and the blonde guard I'd seen from Kugel's window stepped into the dining hall. She was taller than she'd appeared from above. Finally, a fellow female. She ambled over to our table, her steps heavy on the wooden floor, riding crop tucked in one boot, cap off, hair rolled up off her forehead, per the fashion of the time. Though a young woman, 19 years old or so, her complexion already hosted a colony of sunspots and freckles. Perhaps the result of farm labor? Fritz draped one arm over the back of his chair.
"If it isn't the lovely Fräulein Binz, pride of the Ravensbrück Charm School."
Fritz did not stand to greet her, and the other doctors shifted in their chairs as if suffering a cold wind.
"Hello, Fritz," Binz said. "Don't you know you're not allowed in the officer's canteen without permission?" Fritz said.
He lit a cigarette with a gold lighter, his hands white and almost incandescent, as if dipped in milk. Hands you might expect to see on a famous pianist. Hands that had never touched a spade.
"Kugel wants me to get your medical staff and my girls together."
"Not another picnic," Rosenthal said.
"He suggested a dance," Binz said.
A dance? A great fan of dancing, I was interested in that. Rosenthal groaned.
"Only if Kugel throws in a case of French claret," Fritz said. "And only if you staff it with some attractive Poles. Those Bible girls barely speak." "And only bring the Aufseherinnen under 100 kilos, Rosenthal said.
"You will come, Fritz?"
Binz lit a cigarette. Fritz waved one hand in my direction.
"Binz, say hello to your new roommate, Dr. Hertha Oberhäuser. May I present Dorothea Binz, head of the punishment bunker. Also trains most of the Aufseherinnen for the entire Reich, right here."
"Woman doctor?" Binz said. She sucked her cigarette and looked me over.
"That's a new one. Happy to meet you, doctor.
Good luck with this group." She addressed me informally, using the word du instead of sie, which struck me as inappropriate, but no one else noted this.
"Thank you, Fräulein Binz," I said, walking her to the canteen door.
"Never thank an Aufseherin, doctor," Fritz said. "Bad precedent."
Binz let the door slam behind her and strode out onto the Platz. She discarded her cigarette, not even half-smoked, flicking it onto the cobblestones with her thumb and forefinger. It was clear Binz was not the friend I was seeking. After lunch, I walked with Fritz and Dr. Hellinger toward the utility block, where new prisoners were processed. On the way, I saw every Häftling in uniform wore a colorful triangle on her sleeve, just below her number. "What do the colored badges mean, Fritz?" I asked. "Green triangle is a convicted criminal, mostly from Berlin. Rough sorts, though some are here for breaking insignificant rules. Many block of us wear this. Purple is Bible Girl, Jehovah's Witness. All they have to do is sign a paper saying they put Hitler above all else, and they can walk free. But they won't. Crazy. Red triangle is political prisoner, mostly Poles. Black is asocials. Prostitutes, alcoholics, pacifists. The letter sewn inside the triangle indicates nationality. Jews get two triangles put together to make a star. Himmler's idea. We walked to the utility block along a line of naked women waiting outside. The women all appeared to be Slavs of some sort, of all ages and body types. Some were visibly pregnant. When they saw the male doctors, some shrieked, and all tried to cover themselves. "These women need clothes, Fritz," I said. Once inside, we stood in a quiet corner to talk. "Here's how we do our selections," Fritz said. "First, Hellinger looks for and records all silver or gold fillings and bridge work. Then we choose those least fit to work. If those two things line up, the prisoner is chosen. A prisoner too sick to work with a mouthful of metal goes on this list. We tell them anything but the truth." "And the truth is?" I asked. "Express bus to heaven. Either the gas van or Evipan. Gasoline if we run out. After that, Hellinger extracts the Reich's payment. We'll do Evipan today." I hugged my waist. "I thought the prisoners needed to work." "Old ladies can't pull a concrete roller, Hertha. Few of them are that old, and the ones that are can be put to work knitting. And the pregnant ones need to be off their feet." "It's German law. No child can be born at a camp. And a certain percentage needs special handling. Otherwise, this place will be too crowded, and I don't know about you, but I'm not crazy about typhus. And besides, some of them are Jews." The re-education camp label was a front. How could I have been so naive? My nausea returned. "I need to go to my room and unpack," I said.
"You were fine with a cadaver lab at school."
"They weren't breathing, Fritz. I'd rather not be involved."
"Rather not? You won't be here long with that attitude."
"I'm just not comfortable with all this. It's so, well, personal." The thought of administering a lethal injection was too abhorrent to dwell on. Would we inject into the arm? Lethal injections were barbaric and bound to be psychologically damaging for those administering them. I touched Fritz's hand. "But cyanide is quick and quiet, mixed with orange juice."
"You think I like this?" Fritz asked, drawing me closer.
"You do what you have to here. The alternative for them is Vernichtung durch Arbeit. Death by labor, planned starvation."
"It's orders, direct from Himmler. They all get just enough calories to keep them alive to work for 3 months. Slow extermination."
"I can't."
He shrugged. "They'll die anyway. Just don't think about it."
Fritz approached the line of naked women and clapped his hands, and they huddled together like horses in a barn.
Good day, ladies. Any of you who are over 50 years old, have a temperature above 40 degrees, or are pregnant, step to the side, and we'll make sure you get a rest after your typhus inoculations. I can only take 65, so step up now.
The women talked among themselves, some translating Fritz's instructions into other languages, and soon volunteers emerged.
Here, this is my mother, said one young woman as she prodded an older woman forward. She has been coughing so hard she cannot work.
Of course, Fritz said.
One obviously pregnant, a dark-skinned girl with brown, heavily lashed eyes like those of a dairy cow came forward and smiled at Fritz, her arms crossed, resting on her swollen belly. In minutes, Fritz had his 65 candidates, and he instructed a guard to accompany them to the Revier. At least they went along calmly.
"Since when is there a vaccine for typhus?" I asked, keeping my voice low, in case some of the prisoners understood German.
"Of course it doesn't exist. On average, sick heftlings only live 14 days, so we're simply hastening the process. It's far more humane than other methods."
Fritz led us to my new workplace, the Revier, the prisoner medical clinic, housed in a low-slung block identical to the rest. The front reception area opened onto a large room filled with cots and bunk beds, crowded with patients, some lying on the bare floor, some in advanced stages of disease. One heftling hosted such an abundance of adult lice. Her short hair was white with them, and she had scratched great patches of her skin raw. Not a quality operation. A young prisoner nurse named Gerda Quernheim greeted us. Gerda, a pretty chestnut-haired girl from Düsseldorf, had attended the school of midwifery there. She was an excellent nurse, but even Gerda couldn't handle the Revier. Fritz led us down the hall, past a large meat locker, not unlike Heinz's.
"What is this?" I asked, touching the door, cold and damp with condensation. I brushed away a flash of Uncle Heinz's face.
"Cold storage," Fritz said. "Gebhardt's."
Fritz led me to a back room, painted a soothing pale green, two stools and a tall lab table the only furniture. The light caught the silver barrel of a syringe, one of three laid out on the table, certainly not sterile. A gray rubber apron hung on a wall hook swayed with the breeze as we entered. The windows in that part of the building were painted white, like cloudy cataract eyes. It felt claustrophobic, as if we were snowed in.
"Why are these windows painted over?" I asked.
"Gebhardt is a freak for privacy," Fritz said.
"Honestly, Fritz, I am tired from the train today."
"Take half a pethidine if you have to," Fritz said, his brow creased. "Would you rather take last call? Shooting wall duty."
"Shooting wall," I said. "Perhaps this is better."
"Much tidier. The first is the hardest. Trust me. Like jumping in a cold lake."
Two Aufseherinnen brought in the first prisoner from Fritz's selection, a surprisingly spry older woman wearing only wooden clogs and a blanket over her shoulders. She tried to speak to Fritz in Polish through a jumble of confused teeth. Fritz smiled.
"Yes, yes, come in. We're just preparing the inoculations."
He tied on the rubber apron.
"Kill them with kindness," Fritz said. "Makes it easier for all."
The Aufseherinnen led the old woman to the stool. Over my shoulder, I watched Gerda load a 20cc hypodermic syringe, drawing enough yellowish-pink Evipan into the barrel to kill an ox.
"We painted this room pale green since it soothes patients," Fritz said.
The Aufseherinnen removed the blanket, wrapped a towel around the woman's face, and held her left arm out as if preparing for a venous injection.
"Injections were not my forte in medical school," I said.
One of the Aufseherinnen pressed her knee into the old woman's back to thrust her chest forward. Fritz pressed the heavy syringe into my palm.
"Look, you're doing them a favor," Fritz said. "Think of them as sick dogs needing to be put down. Do this well, and they won't suffer."
The woman must have seen the needle, for she began to fight the guards and flailed her freed arm. That would be all I needed, Fritz telling Kugel I couldn't handle a syringe. I backed away, a milky drop at the tip of the needle. "I'll try it tomorrow."
"Here," Fritz said, wrapping his arms around me from behind. "We'll do it together."
He covered my hand that was holding the syringe with his and placed the fingers of my other hand on the woman's skin, above the ribcage. The guards used her arms like a straitjacket, and Fritz slid my fingers down the torso to the fifth rib space.
"Close your eyes," Fritz said. "Feel it? Just below the left breast."
I pressed my fingers deep into the warm, crepey skin.
"Yes," I said. "Good. Almost done."
Fritz placed his thumb over mine on the plunger, guided my hand to the spot, then helped me plunge the needle in. I felt the pop as it punctured the rib space.
"Stay with me now," Fritz said, his lips soft against my ear. "Breathe."
Fritz pressed our thumbs against the smooth knob with steady force, sending the EpiPen straight to the heart. The woman reared back, but the guards held her in place.
"Steady now," Fritz said, his mouth close to my ear. "Just 14 seconds. Count backward."
14, 13, 12. I opened my eyes and saw the towel fall from the woman's face, her lower lip pulled down in a hideous grimace. 11, 10, 9. The woman struggled, and I took deep breaths to fight a wave of nausea. 8, 7, 6. She reared up as if in cardiac distress, then fell limp and unresponsive. Fritz released me.
"She was a quick one," he said. "You're drenched."
One of the Aufseherinnen dragged the old woman off to the side of the room. Gerda left to fetch the next subject.
"Gerda is Rosenthal's girlfriend," Fritz said as he made notes on a clipboard.
"He did a termination on her. Keeps it in a jar in Gebhardt's refrigerator. She picks pet heftlings to treat with a warm bath, complete with flowers, combs their hair, and tells them sweet stories before she brings them here." I walked toward the door for air.
"How do you do this, Fritz? It's so..."
"It's no glamour job, but if you leave, there will be a replacement here tomorrow. We handle a certain quota every month. Orders from Berlin. It can't be helped."
"Of course it can be helped. We can refuse to do it."
Fritz refilled the syringe.
"Good luck with Kugel on that one."
"Well, I can't do this. How could I have ended up in such a place?" Hellinger entered the room with his leather roll of tools. I tried not to listen as he removed the woman's dental metals. He stamped the cheek with a star to mark her as completed.
"You'll be fine, Hertha," Fritz said, "once you get used to it."
"I'm not staying. I didn't go to medical school to do this."
"That's what I said, too," said Hellinger, with a laugh. He tucked the cotton sack of gold into his coat pocket. "Me too," Fritz said. "And then, before I knew it, 3 months passed. After that, you're here to stay. So make up your mind soon."
There was no question. I would be gone by sunrise.
Chapter 10. Caroline. 1939 to 1940. In the darkness of the bedroom, I felt for my clothes. I found my slip and slid into it, then felt Paul's velvet jacket and threw it on, the satin lining cool on my bare arms. Who was pounding on the apartment door? Stay here, Paul. I'll see who it is. He lay back against my pink satin pillow, his Cheshire cat smile white in the semi-darkness, fingers locked behind his head. This was funny. What if it was Mother? What would I tell her? The world's handsomest man is in my bed half-naked? But Mother had her own key. Maybe she'd left it behind? I inched down the hall. Who would create such a racket? I passed the dark living room. In the fireplace, orange embers still glowed.
"Caroline!" came a voice through the door. "I need to see you!"
David Stockwell. I stepped closer and put one hand to the painted door. David pounded, and it vibrated under my fingers. "What are you doing here, David?" I said through the door.
"Open up," he said. "It's important."
Even through 5 inches of oak, I could tell he'd been drinking. "I'm not dressed."
"I need to talk to you, Caroline. It'll only take a minute."
"Come back tomorrow, David."
"It's about your mother. I need to speak with you. Most urgently."
I'd been through David's most urgent situations before, but I couldn't take the chance. I flipped on the hall light and opened the door to find David in rumpled white tie leaning against the door jamb. He pushed by me into the vestibule, his gait unsteady. I pulled Paul's jacket tighter about me to hide my underdress state.
"It's about time,"
David said.
"My God, Caroline, what are you wearing?"
"How did you get past the doorman?" David took me by the shoulders.
"Please don't be mad at me, Caroline. You smell so good."
I tried to push him away. "David, stop. What's wrong with my mother?" He pulled me close and kissed my neck.
"I miss you, see? I've made a terrible..."
"You reek, David." I tried to pull away, but not before Paul appeared behind me, dressed in his undershorts and a shirt he'd hastily thrown on. Even in the harsh overhead light, Paul was lovely. The open shirt, my lipstick smeared down the placket.
"You need help, Caroline?" Paul asked.
David, drunk as he was, lifted his head at the sound of Paul's voice.
"Who's this?"
David said, as if confronting an apparition. "Paul Rodier. You met him today in the park."
"Oh."
David straightened.
"How would your mother feel about..."
I took him by the arm. "You need to leave, David." He groped for my hand.
"Come with me, see? Even Mother misses you."
This was doubtful. Even after knowing me for years, Mrs. Stockwell still referred to me as the actress. "Don't call me C, David. And you're married, remember? The wedding of the decade, the papers called it." He looked at Paul as if he'd forgotten he was there.
"God, man, put some clothes on."
David leaned into me, his blue eyes pink-rimmed.
"Caroline, you can't possibly think he's good for you."
"You have no say in my life, David. You gave that up on one knee in front of everyone at the badminton club. Did you have to propose at Father's club? He got your father in there." Paul walked back to the bedroom. With any luck, he was going back to the bed.
"It's a meaningful place to us. Sally and I won mixed doubles there.
News of Sally and David's triumphant badminton win had been all over the Sun and trumpeted by the likes of Jinx Whitney, my Chapin nemesis. I'd never liked the badminton club, even when Father was alive. Any club with a shuttlecock in its crest cannot be taken seriously. Paul came back to us in the vestibule, this time buttoned up and wearing pants.
Maybe you two can finish this another time.
He slipped his overcoat on. You're leaving? I said, trying not to sound desperate.
David needs to be shown out, and I have early rehearsal tomorrow.
He leaned to me and kissed one cheek. I breathed him in as he kissed the other and murmured in my ear, "Aubergine is your color." Paul pulled our impromptu guest out the door and downstairs as David protested, using his full repertoire of curse words. It was certainly painful to watch Paul go. He'd left my virtue intact. But was it the last chance for me? At least it hadn't been Mother at the door. I made it through the holiday season, spending more time than was probably healthy with Paul. We listened to a lot of jazz up in Harlem, side by side in a halo of candlelight. He'd taken on a roommate, a member of the Streets of Paris supporting cast, and Mother was back in New York, so it was near impossible to find private time. I saw his play 7 times, watching the company of 100 go through their paces. In addition to playing a lead role, Paul sang and danced in the show, demonstrating great range. What could he not do? The poster for the show boasted the cast included 50 Parisian beauties. With all that female companionship available, it was a mystery why Paul chose to spend his free time with me. Things grew almost unbearably tense at the consulate that spring of 1940, and I practically lived at the office. As Hitler invaded Denmark and Norway on April 9th, sending a new wave of panic through the consulate, the world braced for the worst. One chilly late April day, Paul asked me to meet him at the observation deck atop the RCA building after work. He said he wanted to ask me something. What was it? I'd already offered to sign as Rena's visa sponsor, so that wasn't it. The thought teased me all day. We often met up there to look at the stars through the telescope. But I had a feeling he wanted to talk about something other than Ursa Minor. He'd hinted we should co-star in something. Maybe a one-act play? Something off-Broadway? I would consider it, of course. I made it up to the deck early, as usual, and waited. A trio of nurses huddled in yellow Adirondack chairs, which ran down the middle of the deck, then snapped pictures of one another in front of the sign that read, "A proof of your visit. Be photographed on the RCA observation roof." Only an elbow-high iron railing separated us from the edge, so all of Manhattan lay below us. The East River to our east, and Central Park to our north, like a lumpy brown saruque rug someone had unfurled down the middle of Manhattan. To our south, the Empire State Building rose up, and to the west, the 50th Street docks jutted into the Hudson, lined with ships waiting their turn to sail. Below us, a message painted in white stood out, bright in the deepening gloam, against Macy's dark roof. Macy's. It's smart to be thrifty. Paul arrived, a bouquet of Mouguet in hand.
These are early, but I hope you don't mind.
Of course, he referred to the French tradition of giving loved ones Lily of the Valley on May 1st. I closed my hand around the emerald stems and inhaled the sweetness.
Hopefully, next May 1st, we'll be together in Paris, he said.
I slid the bouquet under the décolletage of my dress, the stems cold against my chest. Well, New York is lovely on May Day. I stopped. How had I not noticed? He was more formally dressed than usual, a red silk handkerchief in the pocket of his navy blue jacket. He was leaving. "You're looking chic," I said. "You've broken out the white flannels. Some people dress that way to travel." It was too late to beg him to stay. Why had I not spoken up sooner? Paul pointed to the harbor. "I'm taking the Gripsholm. 7:30 call." Tears pricked at my eyes. A Swedish ship.
"Hitching a ride with the International Red Cross, thanks to Roger. Göteborg, and then on to France. Would have told you sooner, but just found out myself."
"You can't go now. What with all the U-boats and X-craft out there? Surely it isn't safe. You'll be sitting ducks on the water. And what about Rena's visa?"
"Roger says it may be another month before I find out."
"Maybe if Roger calls Washington..."
"There will be no last-minute miracle, see. Things are just getting worse."
"But I need you to stay. Does that not count for something?"
"I am trying to do the right thing here, Caroline. It isn't easy."
"Maybe wait and see how things progress."
"Roger says he'll keep trying. It'll be easier to work on it from there, but I have to go. Half of Rena's family has already left Paris."
I leaned my cheek against his coat. "You still love her?"
"That's not what this is about, Caroline. I'd stay here with you if I could. But how can I sit in my suite at the Waldorf while all hell's breaking loose at home? You wouldn't do it."
Was he really going? Surely it was all a joke. He would laugh, and we'd go to the automat for pie. As the sun retreated, the temperature fell, and Paul wrapped his arms around me. His heat was all I needed to stay warm. Even from 70 stories up, we could pick out the individual ships docked at 50th Street. The Normandy still in place. The Île-de-France. Only the Gripsholm was ready to sail, flying her Swedish flag. The wind drew the gauzy smoke from her stacks up the river. I looked east. The mid-Atlantic would be the most dangerous part of their journey, where there was the largest gap in air coverage. Even that early in the war, German U-boats had already sunk several Allied ships in the Atlantic in order to keep supplies from reaching England. I pictured the German submarines waiting there, suspended mid-water like barracuda. Paul held my hands in his.
"But what I wanted to ask you is, will you come to Paris once this blows over?"
I pulled away. "Oh, I don't know, Paul." My mind flashed to us at Les Deux Magots on Saint-Germain-des-Prés, at a café table under the green awning watching Paris go by. A café viennois for him, a café crème for me. As the sun retreated, some Hennessy, maybe champagne and a raspberry tart as we plotted his theatrical career. Our one act. "What would Rena say?"
He smiled. "Rena would applaud it. Might join us there with one of her beaux."
The wind whipped my cheeks and sent my hair into a tornado around us. He kissed me.
"Promise me you'll come. My biggest regret is leaving you with your moral high ground intact."
He smiled and slid his hands around my waist.
"This must be rectified."
"Yes, of course. But only if you write me letters. Long, newsy ones telling every minute of your day."
"I am the worst writer, but I will do my best."
He kissed me, his lips warm on mine. I lost all sense of time and space, suspended there at the top of the world until Paul released me, leaving me dizzy, unmoored. Walk me out?
I'll stay here, I said. Just go. Don't make this any harder.
He walked to the deck door, turned, and left with a wave. I don't know how long I stayed, leaning on the railing, watching the sunset. I imagined Paul in a taxi arriving at the great ship. Would he be annoyed that people asked for his autograph? Only if they didn't. Did Swedish people even know Paul? There would be no one act for us. Not any time soon.
We're closing up,
the roof guard called from the door. He joined me at the railing.
Where'd your fellow go, miss?
Home to France, I said.
France, eh? Hope he makes it okay.
We both looked toward the Atlantic.
Me too, I said.
The morning of May 10th was like any other. I could hear our reception area was full by 10, and I readied for the onslaught by neatening up my desk drawers. Anything not to think about Paul.
More postcards from your pen pals,
Pia said. She lobbed a stack of mail onto my desk.
And stop filching my cigarettes.
It was a lovely May day, but even the tender breeze that rustled the elms outside my window couldn't cheer me that Monday morning. The prettiest days were the hardest, without Paul to share them. I fanned through the mail, hoping for a letter from him. Of course, the chances of a letter from Paul being included in that pile were slim, for mail delivery by transatlantic passage took at least 1 week each way. But I stalked the mail like a scent hound on a fox, nevertheless.
You read my mail? I said.
That's a postcard, Caroline. Half the world has read it, if they care about some French orphanage.
I flipped through the postcards. Château de Chaumont, Château Masguelier, Villa La Chenée. All once stately French mansions converted to orphan asylums. They returned confirmation cards upon receipt of the aid packages I sent. I hoped a sweet soap, a pair of clean socks, a candy, and a piece or two of Mother's lovely hand-sewn clothes, all wrapped in neat brown paper, would raise a child's spirits. I stood and pinned the cards to my bulletin board. It was already crammed with pictures of French children. One of a dark-haired angel holding a sign that read, "Merci beaucoup, Caroline." Another of children posed in plein air art class, one child at an easel, the rest on camp stools, assembled by age, pretending to read their books under a linden tree. I assumed that photo was snapped by the lovely-sounding Madame Bertillon, director of Saint-Philippe in Meudon, an orphanage southwest of Paris. I'd become friendly with Madame Bertillon by mail and waited eagerly for her letters, filled with charming anecdotes about the children and how much they appreciated my packages. There was a new letter from her in this batch of mail, and I pinned up the enclosed crayon drawing of Saint-Philippe, the imposing stone facade colored goldenrod yellow, smoke swirling out of the chimney like the icing on a hostess cupcake. What would it be like to adopt one of these children? A boy? Girl? Our place up in Connecticut, which we called the Hay, was absolute heaven for children. Mother maintained my playhouse, still there in the meadow, complete with wood stove. Adopting a child would give me someone to pass it all down to. Great-grandmother Wolsey's loving cup, our lovely duck-footed table, mother's silver. But I put it out of my mind, for I would never raise a child alone. I knew too well the difficulties of growing up without a father, that aching hole mother had tried too hard to fill. feigning sick every father-daughter day at school, being reduced to tears at the sight of fathers and daughters holding hands on the street, the gnaw of regret that I hadn't said goodbye. At the bottom of the pile, I found a letter written on onion-skin airmail stationery in a lovely hand. The postmark read Rouen. Paul. As well as I knew Paul, how had I never seen his handwriting before? It suited him.
Dear Caroline, I decided to write right away, since, as you say, waiting is not your strong suit. So much is happening here. Rouen has been remarkably sane about this phony war, but many have already left, including our neighbors who wheeled their grandmother away with them down our street in a baby carriage last night. The rest of us now are just hoping for the best. I am in talks to commit to a new play in Paris. All's well that ends well. Can you believe it? Shakespeare. I like to think it is your good influence on me. Rina may have to close her shop. There is little fabric and notions to be had, but she will be fine. Her father has taken to smoking sunflower leaves, for there is no tobacco to be found. I hope this counts as a newsy letter, for I have to go now to make the embassy bag. Do put a good word in with Roger for our visa situation. I think of you often, there at work. Make sure you don't let Roger bully you. Remember, he needs you. With much love, and until next time, Paul. P.S. I dreamed last night I watched you on stage, here in Paris, in a very steamy version of A Midsummer Night's Dream, and you played an angel. Could this say something about your acting career? About my missing you? My dreams always come true.
Paul had made it home to Rouen, past the U-boats. At least he was safe. For a gregarious man, he wrote a succinct letter, but it was better than none at all. A new play? Perhaps things would blow over in France. Maybe the French producers knew more about the situation than we did half a world away. And the dream. He really did miss me. I found an April 23rd copy of Le Petit Parisien, one of the many French newspapers Roger had delivered by bag, somewhat outdated but precious nevertheless. The lead headline read, "The Reich in Scandinavia. British troops fight on land and sea. Considerable success in the war in Norway despite large difficulties." My mood lightened at reading that good news. Maybe the United States would continue to avoid the war. But the Brits were holding fast, despite horrific Luftwaffe bombing. Maybe France would escape Hitler after all. I scanned the theater page. Any ads for Paul's new venture? I found no Shakespeare, but did see a small ad for Rena's shop. A simple black square bordered with a row of pearls. Les Jolies Choses. Lingerie et sous-vêtements pour la femme de discernement. Lingerie and undergarments for the discerning woman. Roger came to my doorway, tie askew, a Rorschach test coffee stain on his shirt.
Bad news, see? Hitler has just attacked France, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, and Belgium all at once. It is just hitting the news now. I am afraid things are going to get bumpy.
I hurled myself after him and watched him pace about his office. My God, Roger, have you called Paris? The oscillating fan in the window cooled one side of the room and then the next. The red ribbon someone had tied to it flapped like a little Nazi flag.
The phones are out, Roger said. All we can do is wait.
I'd never seen Roger afraid before. What about the Maginot Line?
Seems Hitler went around it, over it, under it. He came right across Belgium.
What will Roosevelt do?
Nothing, probably. There's no choice but to recognize whatever government represents France.
Pia came to Roger's door, encryption headphones around her neck.
I tried to call my father in Paris, and I can't get through. I have to go home.
You can't go anywhere right now, Pia,
Roger said.
I can't stay here.
Don't be ridiculous, Pia, I said. You can't just leave. Pia stood, arms limp at her sides, heaving great sobs. I wrapped my arms around her.
It will all be fine, dear, I said.
To my immense surprise, she returned my embrace. On June 14, 1940, the Germans took Paris, and 8 days later, France surrendered. Pia and I stood in Roger's office and listened to radio reports of Nazis marching past the Arc de Triomphe. France was split into two zones, the northern zone occupied by German Wehrmacht soldiers, known as the Zone Occupée, and the so-called Free Zone in the south. Marshal Philippe Pétain headed up the new French Republic, called the Vichy Regime, in the southern Free Zone, which most considered a Nazi puppet state.
What will happen to our office here?
Pia asked.
I don't know, Roger said. We'll sit tight for now. Do the best we can for our people here. Can't get any calls through.
Can the Brits help?
Already have, Roger said. They just shared reports of German dive bomber activity in the English Channel.
We were lucky that Roger was close to what Pia called his British spy friends, our neighbors in the International and British buildings of Rockefeller Center, who were especially generous with their classified information. Roger's personal line rang, and Pia picked it up.
Roger Fortier's office? Oh, yes. Yes, she is. Hold the line.
Pia held the phone out to me.
It's Paul.
How did he get through?
Roger asked. I grabbed the phone.
Paul?
I could barely breathe.
I have only a minute, Paul said.
Paul.
His voice was so clear, as if from the next room. I pressed one finger to my free ear. Was it really him?
Caroline, it's so good to hear your voice.
My God, Paul. We just heard. How did you get a call through?
My friend here at the embassy let me phone. You can't imagine how crazy things are now. It's just a matter of time before Hitler's here.
I can ask Roger to rush the visas.
I don't know, Caroline. This place is practically shut down.
What else do you need?
I must be quick. I just want you...
I heard a series of clicks on the line.
Caroline, you there?
Paul, I'm here.
Caroline?
Don't leave me, Paul.
The line went dead. I listened to the vibration of the dial tone for a moment, and then placed the receiver back in the cradle. We all stood there, waiting for the phone to ring again. Roger and Pia just stared at me, hands at their sides. I'd seen those looks before. Pity. Like when Father died.
I'll patch him through if he gets the free line again, Pia said.
I started back to my office, followed by a terrible feeling that would be the last time I would ever speak to Paul.
Chapter 11. Kasha. 1940 to 1941. Before I could even answer Susanna, the ticket booth door burst off its hinges and three SS black shirts jumped over it into the booth. One grabbed Pietrik off the floor and the other dragged me by the arms out of the booth, the coins from the cash box flying everywhere. We were just visiting, Pietrik said. This is my girlfriend. There's been a misunderstanding.
Girlfriend?
The guard said nothing, just dragged us on. I scanned the crowd for Matka. Where was she? Please, I have money, Pietrik said. The SS guard clubbed him across the cheek. Pietrik,